copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
One of the first books I was given after I came to Christ in the early 1960s was the Journals of George Whitefield. And I've never forgotten a line in that great book. Whitefield, the evangelist who travels ceaselessly preaching the gospel, he said this, "I'm never better than when I'm on the full stretch for God." I've always loved that. Because it's when you put yourself out and you're stretched and you think the challenge is too big and it may call into question everything you are, and yet you break through with the Lord, you always ended up growing personally, but much more importantly, seeing the wonder of the gospel. I remember when I tackled Hinduism and studied under Guru and experienced that. I remember some of the studies at Oxford. I remember when I started to look at the face of evil. Many of you know one of my favorite phrases apologetically is, contrast is the mother of clarity. But another little maxim that I love is that context is the mother of urgency. A lot of Christians have an incredibly banal view of truth because they never stretch it out into the world. And they've never seen the profundity of it in the challenge of the context in which we're living today. And I want to take this truth, which you all know well, I want to take it and put it first in its public and then its personal, private context. Many of us this week have been at Auschwitz. I went for the second time this afternoon. I know Auschwitz survivors. I know Elie Wiesel. I've read scores of the books on Auschwitz. No one has ever plumbed the depth of the irrationality and rationality of evil. One of the most moving stories is of Primo Levi, the Italian Jew. And there was a time when he was at Birkenau, a cold day, and an icicle was growing outside the window of his hut. And he was desperately thirsty. He thought, here's a free drink. He reached out for it, but the guard, seeing him, smashed the icicle into the ground. And instinctively, Levi cried out, "Why?" And the guard said with a brutal coldness, "Here, there is no why." Levi lived 47 years after Auschwitz to be a witness to what happened, that never again. But he always tried to explore the why, and he never found one. And 47 years later, he plunged to his death because of the absurdity of the evil finally overwhelmed him. Why? I've read many of the explanations. To me, one of the most extraordinary of them all is George Steiner, the Jewish literary critic. In his little book, The Portage to San Cristobal of A.H., and A.H., of course, is Adolf Hitler. Steiner the Jew dares to write that Hitler didn't die in the bunker. He escaped to Latin America and lived until he was finally tracked down in his old age by dedicated young Jewish Nazi hunters. But they'd been brought up to think of him as a monster. And here's this old man, talking of going to the bathroom and so on. Far from a monster. And he hardly says a word all through the short novel until the last chapter. And then he gives his rationale for National Socialism and for the Holocaust. And Steiner the Jew dares to say, which many Jews criticized him for, there had to be a final solution. Why? Because the God of Sinai, with his blazing character, had introduced what Steiner calls a bacillus of perfection into the world. His demanding character, "I am holy, be holy as I am holy." And this creates a cancer of unrest, of people who are challenged to face up to the demands of God. You see it in the Old Testament, he says. And you see it, he says, Hitler says, in the white-faced Nazarene, Jesus. And you see it in the secular Messiah, the bearded Messiah, Karl Marx. So he said we had to stamp out this creator of the conscience of the world, and then the world could be itself. An extraordinarily profound, challenging view of why the Holocaust. Now, of course, you can look at many other things. But if we look at the capitulation of the church, why the faithlessness of 200 years of Protestant liberalism? Why the idolatrous nationalism? Why the distortion of the two kingdom doctrine? And coming closer to home with evangelicals, why the shrunken pietism, which is irrelevant to so much of public life? We have to say that the church's failure to respond was rooted in the inadequacy of her faith. And one of the things that she missed most, this in the heartland of the Reformation, which Martin Luther had taught, was a notion of calling, which challenged people to follow Jesus and to go into the whole of life, so there's not an inch of any sphere of life exempt from the Lordship of Christ. It had gone. And wherever it goes, the church is not and never will be the salt in the world. And we have to say with sorrow in many of our countries, Western Europe, North America, there is a shrunken pietism still in evangelicalism. And much of the notion of the calling which integrates the whole of life under the Lordship of Christ is missing. And if we think of this, this is part of the public challenge of calling. But think of it more personally. I tell the story in my book of our first Trinity Forum in Europe, which is in Woodstock, just north of Oxford. And at the sharing time at the end, an extremely wealthy man was sharing with everyone there. He said, as you know, I've made a lot of money in life. Everyone knew he had. He said, to be perfectly honest, I was driven to make money to hire people to do what I don't like doing. And everyone thought he was working up to some sort of a crack and a joke. But then he almost choked up and a tear started rolling down his cheek, his well-tanned cheek. And he said, the trouble is, I've never discovered anyone who could help me find my purpose in life. Not long after that, I was in Silicon Valley speaking at a dinner with many of the titans of the valley, people who'd made hundreds of millions. And the phrase that came up again and again that night, personal conversations and publicly, there must be something more. These were people who, by the world's standards, had succeeded gloriously. Technological innovations, incredible wealth, but there must be something more. Rick Warren is a friend. Here's a little book, outsold mine by many millions. But it's wonderful hearing from Rick. It was obviously students who responded and people at the younger generation, but what was amazing, the titans of the world business community, names that you would know well, household names, they were the ones who phoned him and said, Rick, come and meet with me. I need to discover real purpose in life. Dostoevsky said, the point of life is not just to live, but to live for something definite. Søren Kierkegaard, when he was 21, wrote in his journal, I want to find the answer and the reason for which I can live and die. Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great Jewish philosopher, he said, I want to find the answer to the question which answers all other questions. What am I here for? Purpose. Purpose. You'd think, everyone would think about that. You play a big sports game and you want a game plan. You start a business entrepreneurial venture and you have a business plan. You declare a war and you hope you have an end game. But how remarkable that many people never have any sense of purpose that gives them any plan for their lives. Coming into London on the train recently, I saw this graffiti on one of the walls scrawled up. You only live once, and it doesn't last. So live it up, drink it down, laugh it off, burn it at both ends. You can't take it with you. You only live once. That's the sort of mentality that set off what in America was briefly called the YOLO movement, Y-O-L-O. You only live once. But what they forget when they started that movement, the original saying was this: you only live once, if then. And there are many people, of course, who are living, but not living, because they haven't found any meaning and genuine purpose in life. Now, here, of course, is one of these areas we see the incredible difference between the gospel and many of the other worldviews. I often say, if you look at the families of faiths, faiths that have a common family resemblance, because they all go back to the same ultimate source of reality, you can see most of our worldviews in the world today can boil down to three great families of faiths: the Eastern, the Secularist, and the Abrahamic. And what do they say about purpose? Any of you studied the East, you could boil it down to, they say, forget it. Purpose, meaning, fulfillment? That's the wrong question. Here we are on the wheel, driven by desire, which leads to craving, which leads to attachment. And the problem is, as the wheel goes round, not that we die, but that we're born again and go round again and through reincarnation. So what's the answer? To escape the wheel. So when Buddha was enlightened, he didn't say, "I am enlightened." He said, "It is liberated." He'd achieved the not-self. As Buddha Gosa, one of his followers, said, "I am nowhere a somewhatness for anyone." You cannot find in Hinduism and Buddhism a rich understanding of individual personal fulfillment. Forget it. How about our secularist friends? I was at Oxford and remember A.J. Ayer, and I was at London as an undergraduate and remember being taught in seminars by Bertrand Russell. We live in a world of chance. There's no meaning in the universe. The world is absurd. But if we want meaning, we create meaning. So Russell's picture was always of the Greek giant Atlas. And you've seen the picture. He carries that world of meaning on his own shoulders. Do it yourself. As Nietzsche says, you live to be able to say, "Thus I willed it." Ayn Rand, you so live to say at the end of your life, "And I meant it." Do it yourself, which is terrific. Young enough, healthy enough, wealthy enough, you can do it for a while. But for most people, that's an absurd notion. Where does our Western meaning come from? And we are, by the standards of world civilization, the most purpose-filled, dynamic, entrepreneurial civilization the world's ever seen. Clearly, it comes from the Jewish and Christian scriptures. And just as God said, "Let there be light," and this incredible cosmos springs into being, packed with purpose and information, so God calls people, Abraham and his family, the whole nation of Israel, and our Lord comes down, "Follow me, follow me, follow me." And we rise to follow Jesus. And we are, as it were, microcosms of the grand cosmos itself. And we enter into purposes which God alone knows for us. And he knows us far deeper than we know ourselves, better than anyone close to knows us. So calling is not just be who you are, because that can become static. Calling is also become whom you can become as God knows you can become. So you can see that calling, if you understand it and set it off against the desires and aspirations of our generation, or the failures of the church in our generation, you can see it has profound relevance. Now, what is calling? The way I define it is this, based on the Gospels. When God calls us in Jesus, follow me, everything we are, everything we do, and everything we have is given a direction and a dynamic, because now it's done as unto him and his return when we see him again. Now, that's very easy to say. But in the incredible confusion surrounding calling today, we need to go back to the Scriptures and back to its roller coaster career in history and see some of the great distinctions that have marked calling at its deepest and best. The Reformation, for example. They wisely distinguish between the primary call and the secondary call. The primary call, by the Lord, to the Lord, for the Lord, follow me. Now, as we look in the Gospels, we can see the sort of things that is. We're first and foremost called to know Jesus and his Father, and the heart of everything, intimacy and relationship. And then we're called not to learn 100 doctrines, but to live his way. Loving our enemies, forgiving without limit, and all the things that characterize the way of Jesus that his followers live. And then, of course, the third thing, to introduce others to know him the way we do, the Great Commission, and so on. And that is our primary call. The secondary call, and you can see immediately it's actually a misnomer. The secondary call is not a call at all, it's a response. What the Reformers call the secondary calling is all that we do in response to his calling. So Matthew was a tax collector. Some of them were fishermen. Paul was a rabbi. Lydia was a seller of purple, a businesswoman, and so on. In the same way today, we have teachers and mothers and computer scientists and politics, artists and 100 people. And in the whole of their lives, they're responding to the call of God and living that call out as unto him, the secondary calling. The second great distinction the Reformation made, very important in our modern world, is the distinction between the personal individual call and the corporate and collective call. All followers of Jesus, all Christians, have a call. No one can say they haven't. We're only Christians because we're following the call, and that call is to know him better, to live his way, etc., etc., etc. The common call is true of all of us, and all of us together should be exhibiting it, holy as our Father is holy, dangerously different rather than conformist. But in the terms of the individual call, we are all very different. None of us are the same. Our character's not the same, our personality's not the same, our giftedness not the same. We are like no one else who's ever lived. And in the uniqueness of our individual personality, we have our individual calling to follow the Lord. And of course, that takes not just a reading of the Gospels, but some discovery of ourselves and prayer before the Lord to know what it is that is our secondary calling. I like to define that in three ways, too. First, and this is based on the parable of the talents and the pounds, the discovery of our giftedness. By that I mean the things that we are born with. Secondly, our resources. We're not born with certain things, but through our family background, through the cultures we've grown up in, through the educational experiences we've had, through the resources we've gained as we've moved through life, we have a whole set of resources, and these two, along with our giftedness, are part of our talents and pounds. And then the third part I think that's useful to think of is our spheres of influence, the circles we touch. And again, we're all different. Doctors will touch people that preachers would never reach, businessmen, people that lawyers might never reach. We all touch different circles of influence. And as we think of our gifts God's given us, our resources, and then the circles we touch, these are our talents and pounds. And we've got 1, 2, 5, 10. And here we are in our individual callings, seeking to maximize and multiply those before the Lord and hand them back in when we see Him face to face. The third distinction that's been important over time is the distinction between the normal call and the special call. Every follower of Jesus has a calling, as I said. But there are people, and they're not everyone, who've had express, supernatural callings from the Lord. That's not everyone. Now, the trouble is, some people think that only the special is a call. And if they haven't had it, they haven't been called. The trouble is that the special calls are rather dramatic. So preachers tell the story. There's a doctor in London or New York, and suddenly the Lord calls him to Zambia, to a leper colony or something, and you have this incredible life, very, very different. Now, they're dramatic stories. So preachers tell the story dramatically, and we all hear them. And then in our minds, the experience of the minority, because only a few had that very special audible call of the Lord, the experience of the minority becomes the expectation of the majority. And we all sit there. If we haven't had a call like that, we haven't been called. And all over the Christian world, there are people waiting for it. It. A voice, a vision. And until they've heard a voice or seen the vision, they're just sitting around. Whereas God's given them their gifts. They've got their resources. And it's time for them to get on with it. And if the Lord wants to speak expressly, supernaturally, redirect them in some dramatic way, we're all open to that. And that's the Lord's right as the sovereign Lord. But we're not here to expect that. We have our callings. And for many, it's time to get on with it. If you see that, you can see there's a distinctive difference between calling and guidance. Now, they overlap. They definitely overlap. But guidance is specific. We have in the Scriptures the Word of God as to what we're to do and what we're not to do. It's specific. When the Spirit speaks to us, it's specific. Go here, go there. Don't go here, don't go there. Paul wanted to go to Bithynia. The Spirit directed him to Philippi. Guidance is always specific. But let's be honest. You read the lives of the great saints, you look into our own hearts. We're not guided every second of our lives. Calling is much more entrepreneurial. As many have pointed out, in the parable of the talents and the pounds, the master, the king, two versions, gives out 1, 2, 5, 10, and in both versions, he then disappears. He's gone. There's no supervision. There's no micromanagement. And they have to get on, in his absence, with the stewardship of the talents he's given them. And at the end, they're praised or blamed by what they've done in his absence. Now, of course, we're never totally in the absence of the Lord. But he doesn't tell us every single thing we're to do. Guidance, yes, we're always open to it. And we seek to follow the Scriptures and the Spirit as closely as we can. But in much of our lives, the Lord's given us these talents, and he's given us opportunities, and it's time for us to get on with it like entrepreneurs who don't ask for every little thing to be spelled out. Those are just some of the distinctions that have been made in the past. Let me move on, I think much more importantly, to some of the great master themes. Because when its calling overpowers you with its wonder, it's something that really is the dynamic of your life. Following him in every second of your day and every part of your world. Let me just mention three. First, do what you are. Calling really is about giftedness. I tell the story in the book of Yehudi Menuhin, the great Jewish violinist and conductor and maestro. When he was 80, he told the story of being taken by his family, very poor Jewish family, to the symphony in San Francisco. And from the age of 3, he said, he was fascinated with the violinist. And when he was nearly 4, he asked his father, very poor, if his father would give him a violin. He had no idea what they cost, and later in his life he had two Stradivariuses. He didn't know then. His father, to humor him, told a friend of his, and to humor him, the friend gave him a toy one, made of metal, with metal strings. And when Menuhin was 80, he described as a four-year-old on his birthday getting this metal violin, and he said it was grotesque. It was all wrong. He said, I knew it was wrong, because even then I knew that for me to play was to be. He said he took that toy violin, smashed it on the ground in front of his father's friends. Well, a little rude, but an incredible expression of the giftedness that's bubbling through. Now, geniuses, virtuosi, Mozart, people like that, huge gift, often bubbles through very dramatically, very early on. Most of us are not geniuses or virtuosos. I'm certainly not. We have a much greater range of gifts. And as we grow in our teens, early 20s, we discover what it is we are. Now, a fallen world is not here to fulfill us. The whole notion of tent making. Recognize that the Apostle Paul's calling was to be the apostle to the Gentiles. But he can't go down to the labor exchange. Ah, yes, apostle of the Gentiles, £75,000 a year. Couldn't do it. He didn't want to rely on the wealthy Corinthian patrons. So what does he do? He makes tents. Tent making is a part of his calling. He does everything to the glory of God. It's not the heart. But he does this to make what is central to his calling possible. He's an apostle to the Gentiles. So I'm not saying we have a gift and here's the world to fulfill us. Not at all. It's a fallen world and work is partly creative, partly cursed. But the heart of the joy of calling is knowing who we are and what God has gifted us to be and doing that unto him with all our hearts. Or take a second great theme. Calling means everyone, everywhere, in everything. Alexander mentioned my ancestor, Arthur Guinness, who was actually a wonderful Christian who came to Christ through John Wesley. And you may know the Guinness Brewery is probably the most generous, socially responsible corporation in all business history. But that's beside the point. He was following Wesley's Christian teaching. And among other friends, he was a strong economic supporter, financial supporter of William Wilberforce. You know Wilberforce's story. Playboy, we'd say today. Wealthy, gambling, whoring, as he says. And he comes to Christ at 26. Now he's in Parliament, but he's now a Christian. What should he do? Obviously, resign from Parliament, what a dirty business, and become a minister. And that's what he thinks of. Fortunately, John Newton, whose great song we've just sung, Newton and one other minister said, for heaven's sake, don't. Stay where you are and pray. Ask what God wants you to do where you are. And 2 years later, you know the result. He writes in his journal, the most audacious personal mission statement than anyone's ever written. God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners. And when he died, 47 years later, he'd done both. I remember talking to John Stott. He came to Christ a generation before I did. I came to Christ in 1960. But comparing notes with John, he said that when he came a generation earlier, just as in the 1960s, it was an unspoken thing. If you loved Christ and were all out, what were your choices? Missionary, or evangelist? I tried to go that way, hit my head against a wall, and in enormous frustration, when I was down in Peter May's church, a friend there very kindly gave me a Xerox copy of the 16th century manuscript of William Perkins' Treatise on Calling. No one had ever mentioned the notion of calling, what it really meant in the Reformation. I read this old Xerox copy with funny old English, and it completely changed my thinking and completely changed my life. And John said he'd had the same problem. In his case, he was called to the ministry. But you can see that that idea has run down the centuries. You go back to Eusebius of Caesarea, the early church historian. He says there are two types of Christian life, the perfect and the permitted, the spiritual and the secular, the full-time and the part-time. Of course, the priests, the monks, and the nuns, they're the perfect life. And we lay people, we're the permitted ones. Now, you can see all the problems that come with that, the arrogance and the corruption that go with God's people, and the fact that all the rest of us lay people, we're off the hook. It's up to them to do it, not us. Martin Luther shatters that in the Reformation. That wonderful little book, The Babylonian Captivity. The farmer out in the fields, the farmer's wife in the farmhouse, if they're doing what they're doing by faith as a calling, it's just as high and holy as the preacher in the pulpit. Why? There's no higher, lower. There's no sacred, secular. There's no full-time, part-time. Jesus had no part-time disciples. We're all full-time. It is everyone, everywhere, in everything. And we've got to go back and, by God's grace, challenge every last Christian disciple in Europe, everyone, everywhere, in everything. And then the salt and light will truly begin to make a huge difference throughout Europe. How about one last theme? Probably the one that most people have picked up in my book if they've written to me. Calling means living before one audience, the audience of one. Historians say of our modern world that we are other-directed, not inner-directed. You could take two great British politicians, Winston Churchill and David Lloyd George, First World War and the Second World War, both great leaders. Lloyd George was described as so driven by opinion polls and focus groups and what other people thought, that one friend said of him, when Lloyd George was alone in the room, there was nobody there. He was only who he was in front of other people. Totally other directed. Churchill was described as impervious to public opinion as a diver in a bell. Now, it was said of the Puritans, they were as if they'd swallowed gyroscopes. Their bearings, north, south, east, and west, were internal. Why? Because of calling. Modern Christians have been described as if they've swallowed Gallup polls. We're always thinking 51% are into this, the new thing that, the latest this. You want to be relevant, go there. We're always wondering what other people think. Rather than this sense, we have one audience, the audience of one. Yes, we have other audiences. Doctors don't have patients, they're going to be in trouble. If authors don't have readers, we're in trouble. And you can think, we all have audiences, nothing wrong with that. But as followers of Jesus, we have one audience that trumps all the other audiences. And the only thing that counts to us, what is success? What's failure? What's wealth? What's poverty? No. Well done. That is all that matters. When the audience of one says, well done, then we've succeeded, and not till then. But let me finish by warning of some of the cautions today. Because calling is still surrounded with a lot of confusion and some corruption. First, a lot of confusion about the word. I was given a manuscript, and I've heard many people, even in the last 6 months, referring to vocational callings. Now, that's nonsense. Vocation is calling. All they're saying is calling. Now, where did that confusion come in? What they really mean is occupational callings, or callings in your occupational work. That's legitimate, but vocational callings is saying nothing. Where did that come in? Well, the genius of Martin Luther over work in the Reformation was, he said, over against Catholicism, work too is a part of your calling. That was revolutionary. Gave a dignity and a dynamism to work, a humblest work. But the trouble was, with that new dynamism, work became incredibly successful, people became incredibly prosperous, And then occupation got swallowed up and it just became the word vocation. And now it's been secularized, so we have vocational aptitude testing, vocational colleges. And this is nothing to do with calling. And we need to say again and again, there is no calling without a caller. You have people like Marilyn Ferguson trying to restore the dignity of work. She says we've got to see work as calling, but she doesn't know any caller at all. So all she's using is this different word, calling, which has nicer resonance than work. But if there's no caller, there's no difference, and she has no right to the word. And both in the church and outside the church is a great deal of confusion. And this is one of these terms we need to recover. Calling includes occupation. But we need to be careful how we refer to this and really stress that there's no calling without a caller. Another confusion today, and you see this in this church and outside too, is the use of calling to give a kind of romantic adventure to life. Part of the men's movement, drums in the forest and all that sort of nonsense. And you have Christian books that do the same. For me, the greatest expression of that is Nietzsche in Thus Spake Zarathustra. Nietzsche, you may know, glorious passages which many people pin up on their wall as students or in their lives afterwards. Nietzsche says, there's only a single path for each of us to follow. And in this great romantic passage of adventure, he goes on to say, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, he goes on to say, who was it who said, no one rises higher than when they go on a path that they don't know where it's leading to? And he uses this to build this idea of the grand Superman and his adventure. But I just happened to have read who it was who said that. And Nietzsche quotes it without knowing it, and he doesn't finish the quotation. The person who said it was a Puritan, Oliver Cromwell. And Cromwell finishes the sentence, no one rises higher as long as they're on the path they don't know where it's going, so long as the caller is God. In other words, we go into the unknown and we never rise higher than we go into the unknown, our utmost for his highest, even when the path is unknown, so long as the caller is God. And you can see a lot of the romantic adventuring we have today is really a baseless romance that we've got to challenge. Outside of calling, it means nothing. But let me mention one last confusion, and I hope I'm not treading on any corns. There's a vogue in America, and it may be coming to Europe now, for people of a certain age, certainly my age, people 50 and over, to start to consider their legacy. And we have endless business seminars and Christian seminars where we're called to consider our legacy and what it is we've done with our lives and assess what our lives have amounted to. By historic Christian standards, this is rubbish. We live in a day that's dominated by numbers and quantification and measurable outcomes and all that sort of stuff, targets, opinion polls, and so on. There are things that are unquantifiable. And over much of this talk of legacy, we've got to write, as if any of us knew. Wilberforce was very unusual. 28 years old, two great objects, and slavery's abolished 3 days before he died. And one of the people at his memorial said, how extraordinary that the termination of his life and the termination of his labors exactly coincided. That is very, very rare. We've all read Hebrews 11. These were men and women of faith who saw something. It was way beyond anything their world could fulfill, their generation could see. And it's precisely because they lived in the future of this hope that what God was doing, God was not ashamed to be their God, and he has a city for them. Over most of our Christian ventures, we have to say, incomplete. But we're working in faith. and we'll die in faith. And we know that in the Lord our labor is not in vain, but we may have absolutely no clue what our legacy is. And I wouldn't even bother to think for a minute what your darn legacy is. Work for your calling to your utmost for His highest and leave the legacy for the Lord. And hopefully, well done will be the beginning of it. But let me finish with a word about Europe. Jacques Delors, the French statesman, used to say that Europe is not a UFO, unidentified flying object, it's a UPO. It's an unidentified political object. Europe is new. You know the story of Europa. We've got on our 2 euro coin. Zeus loves the princess Europa in Tyre and comes as a bull and rides off with her. And her disconsolate, grieving brothers set out to search for her, going to the Delphi Oracle and so on and so on. You probably know the myth. And many people have commented on that myth of Europa, have said that Europe is the search for the infinite. And there is today a definite strand of soft utopianism behind the European dream. And of course, the danger is that instead of that utopia they're reaching, we're going to have a vast centralized bureaucratic state that is anything but the free utopia that they have in mind. Europe, of course, has never been united except by the gospel. And the other attempts by force, whether Napoleon or Hitler, and maybe the Eurocrats of the future, will be absolutely disastrous. And I would just challenge you, because one of the missing themes of ELF for me is a passion and a concern for Europe and winning Europe back. We are Europeans. And I've been to smaller, less funded, far less well-organized conferences than this one that have much more passion, prayer, concern, strategic thinking about Europe. And I would challenge you to ask the Lord to stretch your visions and whatever your calling is to include a passion for this extraordinary continent. I'm an Irishman. 1,500 years or more, Columbanus and those intrepid Irishmen set sail from Bangor in flimsy little coracles. And we now trace the trail of Celtic crosses all the way down to Europe and St. Gallen and right down to northern Italy and Bobbio. And as you know, they brought the gospel, they brought the scriptures, they brought education and literacy, and they sowed the seeds, the so-called land of saints and scholars, they sowed the seeds of what became Christendom. Now, you can describe that in grand and glorious ways. Undoubtedly, they were plugging leaks in their boat, and they wonder when they survive witchcraft enemies and all the things they faced. It wasn't all glorious. Much of it was gritty. But can you imagine the vision they had that took them out? And clearly, it was a vision of the Lord. An awe-inspiring vision of the Lord. And we're going to finish with that in our final song, I hope. An awe-inspiring vision of the Lord. But then under that, an awe-inspiring sense of the vision of their calling and what they could do for the Lord in their time. Whenever calling is recovered, the church is dynamic in culture. We're not today, which shows that we're not following calling in all the depths that, say, the reformers did, or certainly the early church did. By God's grace, let's take this great truth with profound seriously. Together, but certainly as individuals, so that the vision of the Lord and the vision that each of us and all of us together are doing in response to His saying, follow me, change us, and by God's grace, change Europe and maybe far beyond. The Lord be with you. Thank you.